welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Turn the Page. I am your host for today, Jen, and I'm joined by a debut author of a really absolutely gorgeous work of historical fiction and myth and magic and sapphic longing and just lots of beautiful things. So let's get into it. Hello, welcome. Could I ask you to introduce yourself and your book, please?
Wow, that was really sweet. I may need a moment. hi, I'm Rose Sutherland, and my book is called A Sweet Sting of Salt, a title which, if I had thought about my childhood lisp, I might not have opted for, because every time I have to say it, it's a moment. And it is essentially a historical fiction retelling of the Selkie wife myth from the point of view of a Nova Scotian midwife who ventures out of her house one night after hearing a noise and discovers a woman about to give birth in her backyard.
It's so lovely, I said, and I have so many questions about your research and, you know, working with myth. But before we get to that, could you tell us a little bit about your journey to the book? Sort of what was the inception point? And if you could also talk a little bit about, you know, coming to writing, because I saw in your bio that you once fell off a roof reenacting Anne of Green Gables. And I'm just wondering how that relates to your process. I love that story.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think really where that comes into it is just I have always been like a highly creative, highly imaginative person, even when I was a little kid, but also with a rather large heaping helping of ADHD, poor judgment calls, because I distinctly remember it was the roof of the shed behind our house, and I was having a conversation with one of my brothers wherein I was like, Anne of Green Gables was a schmuck. That wouldn't be so hard. I could do that. And I didn't even make it to the roof. It was an old building and one of the tiles ripped off. And I just landed flat on my back in the long grass behind and was picking slugs out of my hair for 3 days, knocked the wind right out of myself. It was terrible. But yeah, as to the inception point for this book, it's kind of interesting because I had found my way back to writing after I hadn't really written in years. I used to write a little bit of fantasy when I was like, you know, 15 or 16 years old. And I took a creative writing course for the first time in high school. And I couldn't seem to get more than three chapters into anything. And my teacher, when I handed in stuff where things would always take some kind of weird fantasy plot twist, was like, well, you know, it's fun to read, but no one will ever take you seriously. And so at the ripe age of 17, I kind of was like, yeah, no one really wants to hear anything I have to say, and I'm not very good at this. And I have so many other things I'm interested in, and I wanted to do theater, so I just put it aside. And then I had a rough year one year, and I was like, I'm going to re-embrace all the things I used to love doing. And I started writing fan fiction. It was like Les Mis fan fiction. It's not that hard to find out.
Well, okay, I have to say, I when I was 13, I wrote Les Mis fan fiction too.
Right. You know, see, I'm not alone. There are plenty of people who are just as cringe as I, thank God. But yeah, and I started putting it out on the internet and found that people actually kind of enjoyed it. And then I was like, oh, now I'm writing all the time. This is my hobby. This is great fun. And I found myself in Paris in the middle of a miserable winter while looking for work as a pastry chef. And one night I was, you know, on Tumblr.com as one is, and this thing slid across my dash and it was just, imagine Selkies as like being brought before the UN Human Rights Tribunal as victims of human trafficking, which is not really at all what I ended up writing, but it just gave me this sudden flash of like, oh, I've always hated that folktale because it expects you to sort of empathize with this man because his wife leaves him. And I was like, but he's awful. She should leave him. And there's no reason to sympathize with that. He's kidnapped her. I feel like I'm now accidentally spoiling the book, but that's kind of the joke, because as originally written, part of what came out of those first few days where I was just writing random stuff down and went, hey, I think I could have a novel here. I want to do that just to see if I can do it. Like, there was no plan of publishing. It was just for me. I just wanted to see if I could sustain a story that long. But I landed on this idea that, well, I was really missing home, and I wanted to write about someplace like where I had grown up. And when I came up with this idea of, oh, well, I'll make it a midwife, because there's always a child in this story, it came to me that it would be very entertaining for me to write the whole story and not tell anyone that it was going to take this folklore twist. So in the first draft, no one who beta read it knew what I was doing. I wanted them to be just as broadsided by the final plot twist as Jean is. And then once it ended up getting to the point where I was like talking to editors and things, they were like, no, we actually have to out that this is a retelling of the Selkie Wife so that people will want to buy it. That is, you've buried the lead. And we also need, you know, they wanted me to go back and build in more folklore elements so it wasn't quite sort of left field to everybody, even if it was to Jean. So yeah.
That's so interesting. And I really love that, you know, this beautiful story about displacement came out of a time that you were sort of feeling that way too, and sort of stuck between places, like in this moment of transition. And I'm really interested in the ways in which, let me preface this by saying that, like, I am a recovering academic, some might say failed academic. I used to study women's everyday lives and just like gender and stuff like that. And I'm really interested sort of in the ways in which this story is obviously about the plight of women and like a particular sort of like social arrangement, but also like the interesting ways in which the sea itself gets gendered, you know, and how that is played with too. So that's a very long windy way of saying, you know, the themes and the setting are both so rich, and I'd love to know more about the, like, what your research process was like as you were heading into crafting this story.
This is always the part where I'm like, if I have any imposter syndrome at all, it is that I sometimes feel like a bit of a fraud whenever anyone asks me about research. Because, I mean, I said before about the whole like writing Les Mis fanfic, I picked the year I wanted the story to be 1832, because that's the same year as the student uprising in Les Mis. So it was just a funny joke for me. And like at the time. And, but also because I have read a bunch of stuff about that and just seen a lot of things on the internet, I was like, oh, I don't have to do, like, I feel like I've already absorbed a lot of stuff about that time period. But also because I set it at home, there was already a lot of things I kind of generally vaguely knew about the history of the place. And if nothing else, like a really solid sense of the flavor of things, like just how, like so much of this story actually comes out of just oral history and like my own family telling stories as Annika's family does around the kitchen table. Where I'm like, and a lot of those stories are actually very much cribbed from my own family. So some of them are going to recognize things there. I feel like even though people keep going, oh, this has been so well researched, I feel like I didn't do a lot of research. I would research fine details. Like if I was going to hang things like, oh, well, could Murin or could she possibly get a divorce? I'm like, okay, I know. And then I'm like, wait, let me check. I'd better be right about that, legally speaking, at this time period. You know, and things like when I started looking and I was like, oh, well, I want to start off with this prologue from when Jean is a child with a ship burning in the harbor, which I started writing out of absolutely nowhere. Like it was just like a fantasy in my head that I was like, oh, this is nice. And I know how I want to echo it way later. And then when I ended up in Mahone Bay, while I was busy writing this, because Mahone Bay is a real place that Barker's Bay is very much kind of mapped onto, I discovered that there were so many things that I had made up that really existed in this real town, up to and including the fact that this ship, the Young Teaser, had exploded and burned in the harbor at the very end of the War of 1812. And I was like, oh, perfect, great. Now I know how old Jean is, like everything's perfect. Like, oh, you know, just I have had so many lucky coincidences with things that I made up, dovetailing with things that actually were. And then there are places where I have totally just been like, yeah, well, that's not true. Or I have no idea if that's true, but it works. And if I can make it sound like it's accurate, that'll do.
Yeah.
Because historical fiction, right? I'm like, we lean hard on the fiction in this. This one goes far enough to be kind of fantasy. So I'm like, yeah, no, I can get away with some stuff.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I think like something that it does really well is, and you said that this was a concern in your author's note, if I remember correctly, is sort of just getting, as you say, like the flavor of everyday life rather than like, you know, the ways history usually gets told and like big events and big names of men and all that kind of stuff. And like, so there's like a lot of domestic type history there about like what a woman's everyday life would have been like, which is, you know, again, not something that men wrote about. So it kind of makes sense that that comes from like oral history and stuff like that too.
That's also the part that's always fascinated me, by the way. Like, I'm one of those people who watches all of those, like the Ruth Goodman, like Life on the Victorian Farm thing. I'm like, it's the domestic stuff that interests me. You know, I got bored by the big events in high school. I feel far more connected to figuring out how people really lived.
Yeah, because I think that tells you a lot more about the shape of their lives than, you know, events that they might not have heard of until, you know, weeks or months after they happened, you know? And this story does explore that in a lot of interesting ways, particularly in the role of a midwife in society before, you know, fully modernized medicine, let's say. So could you talk a little bit about Jean, about like her role as a midwife and how that sort of, you know, it makes her very essential to her community, but also places her slightly outside of it. So can you talk a little bit about where you conceived like her role and how she fits into her world?
I mean, the original conception was just as soon as I started thinking about the myth I was building out from, I was like, okay, well, if this woman, baby, therefore midwife, like literally that was the whole thought process. And then I was like, okay, what do I know about midwives? And I did some reading. Like I've got sitting behind me on my bookshelf, The Birth House by Amy McKay, which is another great Nova Scotian. And I mean, I read it years ago. And then I was like, ooh, I purposely don't want to read that now because I don't want it to influence what I'm doing. Like I do a lot of like letting things filter up from things I've encountered in the past to see what happens when I come at it organically. But also just doing a lot of like reading around the internet where I was like, okay, let's look up things that midwives were doing, particularly in that stretch of coast, like Atlantic Canada. I read a great play at one point. And if you think I can remember the name of it right now, you'd be wrong. But it was about a woman in Newfoundland who was a doctor and midwife, and like all these insane stories about people coming to get her in the middle of the night because, you know, someone had cut their leg off 2 miles away and, you know, hoping that when you got there, they wouldn't already be dead. And, you know, and stories about people being like midwives being lowered over cliffs in baskets to be put into boats to go out to like islands and things like that. And I was like, this is intense. This is like, I was like, this is like beyond just like, oh yes, I'm committed to my career. Like it takes a special kind of person with a certain amount of selflessness to the point where it's almost seems a little odd, you know, where I'm like, what went wrong that you feel the need to help people this much that you are putting yourself in this kind of danger? And I feel like that kind of came out a bit in Jean, because she's this character who has a deep sense that while she knows that people need her, She's so convinced that no one actually wants her. And that became really essential as I was picking it apart and editing and refining to who her character is, that as a midwife, she has made herself essential to the community. And in fact, that's been very important to her because it means they cannot cut her out entirely. But she is almost more convinced herself than there is even actual proof by the point this story begins, that she isn't really wanted and will not be accepted fully as a member of the community, except for what she can do for them.
That is such a good point and very sobering too. I think that's like, as somebody who has like people pleasing tendencies in their background, you know, that
I wish people aren't going to be able to see this, but the way my eyes just widened and I nodded my head like a bobblehead, I'm like, yeah.
Like you want to make yourself useful, but then that like creates that dangerous thought of like, oh, if I were not to be useful in this way any longer, would I still belong? So like that is such a really poignant way to sort of like talk about the way that she fits into her society, the way she fears she does or doesn't. And that sets her up for why her relationship with Murin is going to be so powerful. Could you talk a little bit about like how you crafted their dynamic? Because it's a really gorgeous slow burn. And I love the sort of tension between the things that are bringing them together and the things that are pulling them apart, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because it started out, I was just like in the very early stages, it was just all, I mean, frankly, it was quite surface when I first started. And I was surprised how quick things got very deep and very serious. Because I realized that in Jean, I had set up someone who was so lonely and so needed to be wanted that dropping someone into her lap who depended on her so much for a period of time was like just this perfect crucible to create this really tight bond to the point where it was, you know, almost irrational how strongly attached she gets to Murin, how quickly. But I always get the sense throughout the story that first off that like Murin, yes, Murin does very much need help. But if Murin were not trapped, and while it's not super explicit, it is kind of there backgrounded that there is a magical element to because of what has happened to her that she can't really fight back. But boy, would she like to. You know, and so she rebels in all of her little ways, but it is very clear that Murin is not at all, you know, concerned about, you know, Jean potentially taking it the wrong way that she's interested. She is putting out all the signals she can. And Jean, meanwhile, is like, oh no, she can't possibly mean that. Oh no, you know, standard clueless lesbian behavior. With a side order of having so much anxiety and so much baggage around the way her first relationship ended, that she's just like, no, I cannot risk this. I don't want to risk this friendship we're building. And, you know, and she's in so much denial about things for quite a while. And then once she's like, oh no, okay, this is something that's reciprocated. I'm not just dreaming this. She's so all in so quickly.
Yeah, it does like it is at once like a sort of love at first sight and a slow burn at the same time, kind of, I think, because of like the society that they're in, you know. And I love like reading about romances in time periods that were like very socially structured and like that really determined like what you were allowed to say and what you weren't allowed to say, you know, and how that creates so many opportunities for like how what you say might actually relate to how you are really feeling, you know? And so I love like just the very many layers of expression that you get to play with. Yeah, what was like writing their dialogue like, you know, how do you write their like intense feelings in this like, you know, very highly socially structured society?
Yeah. And that makes for a really fun challenge because it means that you always have to be considering what the subtext is. Like all the time. It's like, okay, what is this person saying and what do they think about it? And how do I do that so that the reader hopefully will be able to pick up on what they are saying with what they're not saying. But also there's a whole other layer in this with Mirren's initial inability to speak a lot of English. Mm-hmm. And yes, I purposely made her the kind of person who would pick it up quickly, because otherwise I would have been sunk. But to play with things where she would come out with things that were either very straightforward, or conversely, things where she'd say something that should have been straightforward, but then it wouldn't quite make sense. Like, just so it added an extra layer of tangle into the net of their conversation. She says, falling straight back into sea metaphors. Yet sea metaphors come real easy to me. So, you know, when it comes to that, like that part of this book comes real natural. But I find that even outside of Gina Mirren, there's an element of that all the way through. Like, when people make veiled threats, it is real obvious to the person they're threatening what they are saying, you know, it's a classic staple of growing up on the East Coast, is knowing that everyone is always, as that there's a, you know, there's a song where there's a lyric about people laughing and joking and telling stories about their neighbors. There is, like, people are very kind and very nice. And that is something that, you know, the tourists continually remark upon, oh, people are so nice here. And I'm like, they are, but the skill with which someone can shoot you down without you even realizing it has happened, because they are so clever with what they don't say, what lurks under the surface, is always really, really interesting to me. And I love playing with that in dialogue.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. Yes, like if you can talk in ways that sort of like actually say what you're not saying, like it's a really nice balancing act, I think. And it really makes it about like so many different kinds of like interpretation and translation, right? Like there's so many like different layers of communication and all this, and performance, and you know, there's so much. Speaking of the writing and prose, you know, it's really lovely and it has a really beautiful flow. And I wonder, oh, you're welcome. When you write, do you think about how it sounds out loud, or is it like a fully sort of internal, like a texture of the words type thing for you?
It's a bit texture of the world. I always say it's very much about rhythm. But it's not so much an out loud rhythm, although every now and then I will go to say something out loud after and be like, wow, that clunks. But I find that, like, I grew up reading a lot and living a lot in my head. So I have a very strong internal voice. So it's like, even though it's not out loud, I have a sense of how things sound and the rhythm. And there's like, I keep making this looping motion with my hand, but you know, it's like there really is a flow to things. You know, I also have my patterns that I occasionally am like, okay, you cannot do that at the end of every sentence. You know, you cannot end every chapter with a single line. You can, you know, that kind of thing. But there is very much a build to things where it's like, oh, okay, I see where this is going. I've studied some Shakespeare, so I have a tendency to write long sentences with a lot of commas, which then my editors are like, why all the commas? Why so many commas? And I'm like, oh, that's because I put them wherever I would expect a person to breathe.
Yep.
Which is, you know, not how one is supposed to do that in literature. But I have some, like, there's the prose and the dialogue. And within the dialogue, I have a really strong sense of just what everyone sounds like. I get voices really quickly, which sounds like I'm talking to people in my head. But like, you know, so when people do develop weird vocal patterns, but I find that the prose pattern, to me, when I try and read it back out loud, it sounds like that soothing voice that I would want to have if I were attempting to read, like to tell a story aloud to people around a campfire. You know, that kind of like that sort of low, a little bit spooky, with patterns and repeats and, you know, and little odd little vocal, or not vocal, odd little word games played in it, you know, that kind of thing.
That makes total sense to me. And I think in a way that sort of like lull, that soothing thing also, you know, bring things full circle, like evokes sort of like the tide of the ocean, you know, like in sort of like that sort of like natural sort of like rhythm, you know, that's sort of like internal, if not like really explicit. But yeah, it's so lovely. And gosh, just thank you for coming to talk to us about this book. Like, are you working on anything else right now? What's on the horizon for you?
So officially, I do not have anything that I know for sure is coming yet. I have got one book entirely drafted that I'm kind of tweaking with, and another one that I'm in the middle of working on, that I'm hoping my editors will pick up, that is set in, I've mentioned earlier being in Paris for a while, but I did a pastry internship in rural South Central France. I would say, you know, South Central, like it's LA. And I happened across while I was there at a time when I was not even thinking about writing, a little plaque dedicated to a very odd historical event. And I was like, oh, that's weird. And it kind of stuck in the back of my mind. And I was like, oh, that sounds like almost like Little Red Riding Hood-esque to me. It just gave me ideas about that. And about 2 months ago, all of a sudden, it slammed into the back of my head again and was like, oh, no, but it's this kind of a story and you could do this with it. And I just sent this utterly unhinged email to my agent and was like, so I had this idea. And it's again, it's more historical fantasy, so it's closer to being like what Salty is than the other thing I had already written. And she was like, yeah, do you mind if I take this to your editors right now? And I was like, well, I haven't written any of it, but okay. So I'm trying to get some material together for them to see what they think building on it, but it's edging towards something that's almost more of a Beauty and the Beast narrative at this point. And yeah, and it's set in basically the Occitan region in the mid 18th century.
Lovely. Wow. I am very interested in that. And I hope that you'll consider coming back and joining us again when that is, you know, in the world and a thing. Yeah. Thank you again. Thank you for joining us and sharing this book
Thank you
with
so
us.
much for having me.
No problem. All right, listeners, it is now your turn. You're going to check out A Sweet Sting of Salt. When you are hearing this, it will be out in the world. So please head to your favorite library or independent bookstore, wherever you like to get your books. And yeah, thank you for joining us. It is now time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.